Radio lesson number one, go to the microphone. We are going to be recording this again. Okay, welcome to the Sarah Lawrence Radio Conference. We're just going to get this down.
On Twitter, at SLC RadioCon.
So we are going to be uploading the session. So if you miss a session, we'll have it available in the next couple of weeks. And it is going to be broadcast on Free 103's community radio station at the beginning of October. So we'll let you guys know about that, too. So, but you're not here to see Sally and me. You're here to see all of our wonderful presenters. And so we will go ahead and get started. Here in this room, we have Amy O'Leary from the New York Times giving a presentation.
So thank you guys for staying in this room. I feel like I haven't even done anything and I won your hearts and minds. I'm here to talk to you a little bit today about some of my adventures in multimedia and really about how sound and image come together. But I want to back up for a minute and talk first about why it's been surprisingly important to me. So 5 years ago, I was hired at the New York Times as their first ever audio producer. I'd worked in public radio, and they had this job opening, and I thought, well, shoot, that sounds like exactly what I know how to do. But what exactly does the New York Times want with someone who knows how to make audio? I mean, we had a website. We weren't broadcasting. Audio, I don't know if you guys have noticed, but audio by itself on the web doesn't tend to do very well. So it's been an interesting 5 years. I've had basically a different job every year I've been at the Times and have learned a lot about moving into different kinds of multimedia. And I want to take you through a little bit of that journey and talk a lot about why kind of the backbone of audio and then marrying audio to images is a really great foundation for thinking more broadly about innovative and creative multimedia beyond those disciplines. So to begin with, I'm really lucky. I work with a lot of great people. We work on a lot of cool projects. These are just two examples of things we do that I've worked on that incorporated things like motion graphics and interactive video. And the main difference with my work in radio is that working on projects like this, everything is a collaboration, right? So everything I do, I'm working with reporters and editors, I'm working with photo editors and photographers, people who don't share the discipline that I came to the Times with. And through all that, I came to view audio slideshows pretty differently than I did when I was starting out. I think, we think of audio slideshows when I first got to the Times are going to be the next big thing, and we were producing like tons of them. We did, I probably did 50 in the first year alone. But some people ask me, well, is this kind of multimedia the future of journalism? Is it what's going to save journalism? I don't really think so, but I think it's really important because audio slideshows are almost like the most fundamental building block, the most foundational like brick if you want to understand how to put different formats of media together in an online environment. They're a really simple, easy learning tool. And so we've trained 50 plus producers at the New York Times on how to do them. We trained a lot of people in audio production and then working with our photo editors, learning how to do kind of that basic intermarriage of two formats at once. And you can learn a lot from it that's applicable to other things. So sometimes it's frustrating and sometimes it's amazing, but even if we're working on projects like this, where this was an animation we did about how Wall Street essentially like was moving money around for tax advantages. Even for a project like this, which doesn't seem like it has anything to do with audio or radio, the audio is tremendously important. We've learned with projects like this that you have to have a fun, kind of snappy audio track for any animation to make sense or work. And we've got like amazing visual designers and graphics people, but without that backbone of an actual story, a narrative that works in a linear way in the same way that a good radio story works, we're kind of lost. You kind of end up with like static images that are really fancy, but don't necessarily like move you or make you feel anything. So that's always really good news for audio producers to hear that this is like foundational, like important, an important thing to understand to move forward. But when I first got to the Times, like people did not care about audio. It was not important. This is what people thought of when they thought of audio, right? Like, we're a newspaper. This is how we handle dealing with audio. We throw a couple recorders at some politician's feet. Maybe we get a quote and maybe we put it up on the website. And the first couple weeks on the job, I got a lot of terrible audio dropped off on my desk. I won't scorch your ears by playing how bad it was, but I will tell you that in one instance, we had a reporter interview President Obama during his first weeks in the White House, and even he said, "Don't you want to bring that recorder a little bit closer, like to the reporter?" And she was like, "No, it's fine. We couldn't use any of it." But you know, all that said, going back to the point that audio really is kind of the foundation for a lot of work that, that may be surprising. So I have had the challenge of when I got to the Times, there were all these photographers who were like, oh, audio is really easy. I'm just going to, like, you know, I actually had one photographer take the recorder and duct tape it to to a dugout wall for spring training. He was going to do an audio slideshow about baseball, and he thought, well, the way to do this is I'll take a bunch of pictures and I will duct tape the recorder to the wall of the dugout and somehow we'll get a magical audio slideshow. It didn't quite work. So what I want to share with you today are six lessons I've learned about multimedia and how we cross from one medium to the other. So if maybe you've dabbled a little bit with radio making or with taking photographs, or you're an expert in one area, what is it that we can learn about kind of marrying these two things together, and how do those lessons apply for different disciplines? So the first lesson comes down to a really basic thing, which is just respect. I think this is really important. We sort of have this we're in this world where there are all these tools, right? Really easy things you can have on your phone, you know, simpler devices. It's a lot easier now than it ever was to make something. And I think that kind of lulls us into thinking that, oh, well, then we can all go make a documentary. We can all go, you know, use these really simple tools to make really amazing work. But I think what we forget with that, and what it lures us into thinking, is that you don't necessarily need to build a habit of craft, or you don't need to learn, like, how to do it really well. And I think it's seductive, like, all that technology is sort of like, well, go make your fancy documentary. I've seen a lot of starting work that's really ambitious, but maybe didn't have sort of the craft behind it. And so, you know, when I mean, I've seen this happen, and I'll show you lots of examples of this through the talk. There was one instance where a radio team, they made a nice documentary. They found a bunch of photos on Flickr to illustrate it. That didn't necessarily respect the craft of photography, which is like a discipline like any other. I've seen photo-driven organizations, let's just start with the first, one of the first assignments I had at the Times. We were doing a big series about China and environmental sort of pollution in China, and we had all these amazing images, but we, at the time, we were limited. We could only play them big on our website if they were in an audio slideshow. So I was handed this set of images and said, make an audio slideshow. It's kind of a little bit of a nightmare because there was no audio. How do you do that, right? And you know, there are lots of tricks we use to sort of get around those gaps in production, but what I learned at this project was that there is a whole separate world of skill in doing a photo edit for a simple piece like this. Now, this is a very basic piece, but I do want to play it just because I want you to think about a little bit about how the photos are sequenced and what you're learning from the photo edit, which I did not understand when I embarked on this project. There was a great photo editor who worked on this with me. But Okay, so you guys noticed what was missing there in an audio slideshow, which is audio aside from the music, right? So, first, a quick word about the snapshot view. This is something we're going to look at after we look at a slideshow. This looking at a piece this way is a little bit like taking its pulse, seeing the variety, movement, angle, light. There's a lot to like in the photo edit here that I didn't understand when I first worked on this piece. Just not so much in the audio edit. It was, you know, we sort of took some music and tried to cut it to fit what was going on here. You know, one of the things that I was being taught when we were working on these pieces were things like, you know, how you open, how you move from, you know, how you look at movement and how you look at, you know, going wide and kind of coming close and when people come in and out. These are just things I wasn't really noticing, but the photo editors I've worked with have kind of pointed me towards in the work I've done with them. You know, fundamentally, the most, you know, we've done a lot of pieces that sort of were kind of like sights and sounds, like we're taking you to a place. That's very nice, but I don't think it has the same power of the pieces that actually are a little more poetic. And the key to doing work like that takes me to the second lesson that I've learned, which is probably the most important thing, which is to not be literal, right? And this is tricky because, so in audio, we actually joke in audio circles that like radio is your most visual medium, and this is very visual medium because we're always trying to get people to talk in metaphors and to talk in like, you know, visual language. I always think of when I'm making a radio story, it's like I have a stage and I'm populating it with characters. I might say, you know, here was Joe and he looked like the kind of guy who didn't have time to iron his shirts in the morning. You've got this little like, you know, imaginary peg to put on the stage. So you imagine this guy in the wrinkled shirt. And then I might describe, you know, something else and to just keep populating the stage with visual metaphors so that someone listening on the radio can imagine it in their mind. Really great skill, really wonderful skill in audio production. Totally doesn't work when you start adding photographs, right? Because you start explaining what's in the photographs, and then people get insulted. Like their intelligence actually gets insulted. And I want to. It's funny because when the skill gets wasted, you can see how clearly this sort of insults an audience's intelligence when you put a bunch of examples back to back that you found on the internet for the purposes of talks like this. So let's watch.
I have my own lazy boy chair that's comfortable for me that my wife wanted me to get out of the house, so now I have it here.
We have a huge building here, which manure was stored in.
We're in the middle of the countryside here, and there's a huge termite hill.
I've decorated all my walls with pictures of my wife and my son and just family pictures.
I'm looking at a large hole that was left by the heavy equipment they brought in here to scoop up the manure.
There's a little girl in a purple dress with dots, and she looks as if she's collecting termites.
And in that hole is brown water, which is rainwater mixed with manure. I call it manure tea.
Yes, what we're looking at now is wooden seating, kind of wood chaise lounges that are set on the remnants of the old Highline train track.
And wooden, made out of seemingly just right, 2x4.
Right.
This ditch drains into a small tributary.
And she adds a little termite to her little plastic bag.
I also have a noise machine that drowns out a lot of the extraneous noises out there. It's kind of like a washing machine.
Okay, now some of these are just really bad audio slideshows, okay? There were images literally slapped onto a radio piece, right? And this is sort of tragic. I mean, we have a canvas to do something artful, and that's a little bit unfortunate. But even when photos are, can you guys see me at all? Is the glow of the laptop enough? Is it like spooky ghost time? But the photos can even be really like solid and professional, and an audio slideshow can still miss the boat because of this problem of literalism. I want to go deeper into one that you saw a few excerpts of. This is from the LA Times. It's called Home Base is a Parking Space. And basically, I just want you to pay attention to where the duplication is happening in the messages that you're getting.
Hi, my name is Todd Swenson. I am a pilot for Alaska Airlines. When I'm down here, I live in a trailer. It's a 23-foot coachman trailer. I have my own lazy boy chair that's comfortable for me that my wife wanted me to get out of the house, so now I have it here. I've decorated all my walls with pictures of my wife and my son and just family pictures. Some people would say the noise is a big issue, but I don't even hear it anymore. And I also have a noise machine that drowns out a lot of the extraneous noises out there. It's kind of like a washing machine. I live in the Fresno area, so when the company has me on reserve, I can't stay at home, so I have to be down here. And if I'm in my trailer and I'm watching TV or reading a book and the company calls me and says, we have a flight for you, from the time I hang up the phone, I can just stand up and start getting ready for my work by changing clothes, jumping out the door, getting on the bus and going. Bus system runs about 5 to 10 minutes. I can jump out of my door from my trailer, walk about 20 feet, jump on the bus. It drops me off right at the terminal. This has worked out very, very well for me.
So I don't know about you guys, but I found that a little bit repetitive. And looking at this, I guess I feel like there's a big missed opportunity with a story like this, right? You've got a guy who's separated from his family. You've got a guy who's working hard to support his family. There's an emotional tension there that's kind of interesting. Rather than have him talk about, yep, I got photos of my wife and kids on the wall, he could be talking about, God, I miss my son so much. I wasn't there when he, first rode his tricycle, and it breaks my heart. You could have some other content there that is giving you emotional context, that's making the piece richer and deeper, and is not simply repeating what you're already seeing in the photograph, right? We don't need that information. We see his wall full of photos. Part of what I'd like to do also today is, because I'm not a visual expert, I have brought sort of with me some visual experts that I've worked with from the Times in audio. One of them is Nancy Donaldson. She's a producer now at CNN. She has a background in photography and worked on a number of award-winning projects at the Times. I asked her what she thought about audio slideshows like this.
I can either look at those photos and make up a story myself and get the same thing out of the audio, or I can close my eyes and imagine the exact same thing as what I'm seeing. Like, there's no level of sophistication. It's not asking me to do any work. If you do too much work for the viewer and show the sound machine and show the Lazy Boy, show how big the truck is, the whole thing, it's just sort of like, it's too much. You're it's almost insulting, because it's like dumbing it down so much that you're like, this is what it looks like when you get a phone call. This is what it looks like when you read a book, you know? I think, that you could really, I could look at that and not hear anything and tell you what happens. And I can listen to that and not see anything and walk away with the same thing.
And so this style is kind of what I call slide projector syndrome, right? It's like just talking over your pictures. And there's a reason that this has a reputation for being boring, right? Like, we all know this is like the most boring thing you can do is live in the, 1950s and watch your neighbor's slides. Because they're just telling you, we went here, we went to the Grand Canyon. Here's the Grand Canyon. Like, of course, right? It's like, it's A, insulting, and B, there's no mystery. One of the things that I think is really cool about right now is that TV right now is really great. And there are all these great TV shows. And when you start watching them, one of the things they have in common is there's a whole lot of mystery that I don't think would have been in TV shows like 20 years ago. Things like Lost or Breaking Bad, right? You don't exactly always know what's going on. And there's that like urge to want to know more, to like figure out more, that is part of what I think keeps people so kind of engaged and addicted to that kind of work. And one of the problems when we're working in multimedia is, I'm working in a newspaper organization where they teach you about journalism. Okay, the five W's and inverted pyramid and tell everybody exactly what you're doing right up front. Well, that doesn't exactly work with this kind of journalism, because you're basically not leaving any room for the reader, and there's no mystery. And so there's no real reason to stick around and watch whatever you have. It's sort of like you're telling me a bunch of facts over and over again. I think it's much more interesting when you're sharing secrets and surprises with people, and the tone of your piece does that. So how do we overcome this problem? It can be through things like, very high art. It can be through simple, subtle direction. And I want to get to the high art stuff in a minute, but I want to start with a really, really dead simple example. This is just reporters talking over photos, very similar, but what they're saying is giving you something extra. The idea is you want to get something from the photos and audio that you wouldn't normally get from a print story, or the photos alone, or the audio alone. You want the total to be more than the sum of its parts. So this example I'm going to play you next is Denise Grady, a science reporter, and Beatrice DeGia, a photographer. They went to Tanzania to a fistula repair clinic. And this is sort of, a fistula is this injury that women have in childbirth where they basically end up, it's awful, they end up like urinating all the time, they can't help it, they have like a hole. And so, but it's a horrible thing that affects their lives, and they're sort of shunned. But a very quick surgery can fix it. So they went to a clinic where these women's lives were being changed by this very quick surgery. And again, we didn't have any audio. But when I sat down to interview them to have them talk about these images, I was asking them for what is it that we can't see in the images? Describe what's going on here on the emotional level that is not apparent from the photos. So this is just a very quick clip of that.
What struck me was how many of them had voices that were very childlike voices, and I thought, here are these women who've had these injuries from having babies, and some of them really are still kids themselves, and that is part of what goes into the risk of getting a fistula. One of them was so tiny and had such kind of a small voice. You know, I'm thinking about Janet.
Janet, yeah.
That when I first met her, I thought, my God, she must be about 15. But she turned out to be 30.
I mean, some of those women have been going through this for years and years. And in 30 minutes, gone, erased. That just felt just incredible. Denise. Showed me those two girls, and she's like, look.
Two teenage girls who both were pregnant at 15 or 16. You know, their babies died. They have these horrible injuries.
And they were just, you know, tickling each other on the bed and just really having fun and laughing. And it was such a breeze of fresh air just to have this moment happening in the ward.
There's a little bit of literalism there, right? You see the girls laughing, but now you have this richer emotional context and know like that like they've been through hell and now they're having this moment where they can tickle and like play on a bed, and I think it means a lot more for that context. So this concept of not being literal, it's probably the most, if there's like one thing you were going to take away from how to think about, you know, merging together different formats, this would be the one. And we're just going to, every other kind of rule or lesson that I've learned really just deepens on this one lesson. So I want to dive into this and other ways we can do it. So even from directing, from rather than being literal, what do we be, right? So if I tell you don't do that, what's left, right? There's a bunch of ways to get around it. You can be abstract, you can provide context, you can share a secret, you can be emotional. And most of all, you can be interesting. And I think that's also one of the really great charges about working in journalism is that like the more interesting you are, like I mean, that's when you're winning. You're like, you know, firing on all cylinders. So I want to pivot then to Damon Winter. He's one of the photographers I work with at the Times. He, almost all of his work is really interesting. He won the Pulitzer Prize for photography covering Obama's campaign the first time around. And I asked him to talk a little bit about this and how it's different for him as a photographer who's very accomplished in the print world to come into multimedia and what he's had to shift.
I think we as photographers have always been trained in the past. I mean, I think before the advent of multimedia is like you're looking for that decisive moment and you're looking for that one photo that encapsulates, you know, as much information, tells the story as best you can in that one single image that, you know, in the past would have run on the front page. And when you're doing this multimedia, you really have to think about the marriage of visuals and audio, how your photos play in a timeline, you know, varying angles, how you fill that time with images. There are so many other things that you have to contemplate when you're shooting for a multimedia piece and when you know it's going to be a multimedia piece.
And that takes me to the thing that all the photographers I've worked with have really talked about, which is really different for them in multimedia, which is details. So the first time Damon Winter worked on an audio slideshow, literally we were introduced and he had a plane ticket to Alaska that he had to leave for in about 30 minutes. And I taught him how to use a recorder really quickly, and then as he was flying to Alaska, wrote up a list of questions that he should be thinking about as he interviewed people for two different stories we were working on together. But the most important thing was that he really shifted his style. Again, instead of looking for that single image for the paper, I mean, one of the pieces we did was about a community on the North Slope of Alaska who was dealing with shale oil, wanting to come in and drill, and what that would mean for these families who depended a lot on, you know, whale meat and the local environment for their sustenance. So, you know, a shot like this where he goes into this man's freezer and says, show me, you know, show me the whale meat, the muktuk you have here, this is never something that would typically run in the paper. It just doesn't tell enough of the whole story, right? But we needed lots of this detail. We needed so much of it because we're basically, it's almost like shooting a film. You need tons of footage that you can edit back down. One of the most common mistakes I see with people who begin with multimedia, and this happens in whether you're doing audio or filming or photography, is that people don't shoot enough. They don't record enough. They think, you know, when I was training some of the reporters at the Times to start working in audio at first, I was like, okay, we're going to make a 3-minute audio slideshow piece. And they're like, great, how much should I record? And I was like, well, probably a lot. And they're like, okay, I was thinking 10 minutes, how's that? And I was like, probably an hour, you know, at a minimum. And it's the same in photography. And again, to pivot to Nancy Donaldson, who has coached so many people on this, she echoes that theme.
Details and transitions are the two things that are not natural to print photographers because they're never going to be on A1. They're never going to be probably even in the paper. I mean, occasionally there are details, but that's not really the shot that they're going for. And they're so crucial to doing multimedia because it's the only way to sort of push and pull people through things. And you can put a detail over almost any bite of ambient or any quote or any piece of narration.
So it gives you this flexibility that you need when you're kind of in the editing room and trying to solve all these narrative problems and trying to like fill gaps. The details and transitions are really key. And probably one of the photographers on the planet who's done more audio slideshows than anyone is Todd Heisler. He is one of our photographers who worked on a series we did a few years back called 1 in 8 Million. They did about 54 audio slideshows profiling a different New Yorker every week. And so he shot every single one of them and learned quite a lot through that process. So this was the project. It was started by two of my colleagues, Sarah Kramer, who formerly worked at StoryCorps, and Lexi Mainland, a web producer on our Metro desk. It ran through 2009. And this is Todd. So I asked him about this, and here's what he had to say about 1 in 8 million.
I mean, doing 1 in 8 million has certainly made me look more. It's made me look for more details. I find normally I would just go for the moments. Now I'm starting to look for more texture and more things, you know, that go away from the moments. And a lot of times they'll get published in the paper. So, you know, I feel like it's made me a better photographer. And, you know, now I start thinking what I would do with 1 in 8 million, because sometimes the opportunities weren't always as rich as others. So, you know, before I would leave the subject, I would just kind of stop and like look around the room, do like a 360-degree scan of like any detail I could find, or just something different, because I knew, you know, we had to cover so much.
Covering, that's sort of it sounds like a negative word, but I want to now play for you my very favorite piece. I'm going to jump back and explain it for a second first. This is also Todd's favorite piece of the whole series, and part of the reason I love it so much was because it does what we're talking about here. Not only is there ample detail that's really surprising, but it's one of the least literal audio slideshows I've ever seen, and it works so well for that reason. I think it's almost like a meditation you enter into, but there's also a great character and kind of a nice series of moments. So keep an eye out for that sense of literalism, or the sense away from literalism, and the details that are used in this piece.
I mean, doing 1 in 8.
Sorry.
I don't have walking shoes. I never owned sneakers in my life. I walk in my boots, in cowboy boots or motorcycle boots. I never get tired. I could be out walking for 14, 15 hours and I don't get tired. It's different to walk here than it is to walk in the country. Last summer, I was shopping for a truck, and I found one in Pennsylvania. So I figured, you know, I'm going to take a bus overnight. I'll get out really early, and I thought, oh, you know, if I can walk, I could easily do 20 miles a day in the city. I got out and I started walking, and there was nothing, just fields, beets, and cornfields. And 5 miles into my walk, I sat down. I actually laid down in the middle of beet field, and I called a taxi to come and pick me up. And I was thinking, you know, I don't feel it in the city. I don't walk fast. I don't walk slow. I walk at my own speed. I have to keep moving. If I'm not moving, my mind isn't moving much either. I go through emotions. Like, I have so many. I'm happy. It's like a swing. Sometimes I'm very sad, frustrated, and irritated. And I think about everything. And that if I don't walk, I can't think. So if I'm not in the mood to bump into people and just be around them, I would go outside the crowds. I can find a street that has nobody on it. It could be in the middle of the biggest rush hour ever, and there's one street in New York City that has nobody on it. I don't think I walk the same street every day. I turn when the light changes. So if I see a light change, I don't wait, I just take a street. I notice buildings. When you actually look up, it's so amazing. There's details in the buildings that I've never seen, I've never paid attention to. And lately, I that's what I do. I feel like a tourist a lot of the times. You know, I'm just staring up the sky. So I notice buildings, I notice people, and the quiet, the noise. It's all here, different times, different places. That's what I love, I think.
So I just loved so many of the touches in this piece, and I asked Todd to explain what he liked about it so much, since it was his favorite.
There's no ambient sound in that, and you think you're doing a piece about the street, and you don't hear it. That's actually what I like about it, because it's so so internal. We also did some other things in terms of content. So normally you would say, oh, I walked in the country. You know, people are reminiscing. Well, we're not going to the country with her. So what we did is we edited the complete opposite of rural, and we went for like one of the most urbanized scenes that she walks through, and just to kind of play that off each other. And we did that a lot in a lot of the pieces where, you know, we would kind of make a hard left turn from the audio just to be obvious about it.
And that seems counter to a lot of people's instincts, I think, when they're starting out.
Yeah, totally. And I've never really liked pieces that were so on point in terms of, like, I'm a carpenter, and I use my hammer, and then you hear the hammering, and you see the hammer, you know. I mean, sometimes you have to do that, but I'd like to avoid that. I mean, we don't want to, we can't answer a lot of questions, but we also have to ask questions with these as well. And you want to leave a little mystery to pieces. My favorite pieces have a little mystery to them.
And how do you get to, you know, a piece where you've got, you know, is that like a two-headed dog? I don't know. It looks like a two-headed dog. A lot of, for people who are starting out, you know, as I mentioned a minute ago, a big part of how you get to a piece like this is just starting with way more material than you might imagine if you're a beginner. And, you know, I asked Todd about this, and you know, there are two simple ways for work like this to fail, right, for an audio slideshow to fail. One is you have way too much audio, meaning it's far too long. We've studied people looking at pieces like audio slideshows at the Times, and they tend to kind of, I mean, I've seen this, we'll put them down in a room and we'll watch them watch the screen and see how they interact, and we'll take the same exact audio slideshow that's like 3 minutes and 1 second versus the same slideshow that's 2 minutes and 59 seconds. And many fewer people will go ahead and click through to the 3 minute, you know, audio slideshow. I don't know what that is, but there's clearly some mental barrier there about people's investment of time if they don't know what they're about to get. You know, so I think if you're pushing, you know, a longer format piece, and some pieces, I mean, I've seen 17-minute audio sketches that are fantastic, but the burden to be, like, amazing and impressive is so much higher the more time you're asking for. The sort of pushing up into higher time categories puts your piece at risk. You're basically giving people more opportunity to say, I'm getting bored here, move it along, I'm going to go check my email or the funny cat video on YouTube, right? So the other way that it can fail very simply is too few photos. So either your audio is running too long or you don't have enough photos, and often those two kind of collude to create the same problem, which is you just don't have something that works because you don't have enough material to make it work. So I asked Todd for this, you know, when he got to be quite a pro at shooting for 1 in 8 million, how many photos he typically shot for 1 in 8 million?
I mean, these were all 3 minutes, and I would say on the average, depending on how complicated complex the storyline was, I would shoot anywhere from 300-400 images to 1,000 images. If I spent the day with somebody, I would shoot 1,000 pictures. The edits would probably get down to about 50 pictures, and then the pieces, the average is probably like 20 to 30 images for a 3 minute piece. The reason we went down to about 50 pictures is because when you start putting these together, it's like a house of cards. And so you start building these things and you realize, okay, if you take one out, you need to have other options. Because even when you listen to the audio first, the way we did, and had that in your mind when you were going out shooting, you still just don't know where you're going to end up. And so you have to be open to serendipity.
These are from his full take. These aren't even the entire full take. It would take too long to go through them all, obviously, but it gives you a sense of the range that he began with. And they generally, you know, my understanding was for these pieces that they would, you know, he might have the 800 or 1,000 photographs. They would sort of, you know, pull them down to, you know, 100 or 200 and then really work to get the final edit down to like 50 to 30. Yeah, question. Yeah, for this series, that's how they worked, and they found that it worked better to fully produce the audio and almost give the photographer the 3 minute audio piece as an assignment and say, now you're going to go shoot this. When we talk about audio being kind of foundational, it was easier for a couple reasons. And one is I think that audio tends to be more literal, so you have more leeway, I think, visually. Two, it's... you know, I just think that there's something about the audio is, I often call it's like an audio piece, it's like a forced linear narrative. You can't jump around in it, you can't skim, you can't skip. Audio and video in particular, you kind of are like on this pathway and you're set. Well, with photos, you can move them around. So like in terms of the production process, it's a lot easier and faster to have your audio track set and then play with how you want the visuals to work. And there's always a back and forth. I mean, for any audio slideshow I ever produced, I probably did 12 to 15 different audio edits based on, I was like, I would do, you know, get a rough audio track down, do a rough photo edit, see, okay, I'm going to swap those photos, so I need to swap that audio. It's always a back and forth, but it does really help to just have some kind of stake in the ground, and it tends to be simpler for audio to be that stake to begin with. Now, that said, I would usually start a project with a photographer, and I would say, you know, like if we were beginning the editing phase, I would say, tell me what your favorite images are. Tell me, like, your 2 or 3 favorite images. Tell me if you have any really strong feelings about images that should open or close the piece with. Generally, they had ideas about that, and their instincts were better than mine visually, so I tried to kind of use that. And then you need total flexibility just to get the story to work. But we'll play some examples a little bit later in the talk that show some really creative photo editing that got around some of those problems. But if this was sort of one end of the spectrum where you've got, you know, 1,000 photographs to work with, here is the other end of the spectrum. I'm not going to hurt you by playing you the original piece. This is one of the very worst audio slideshows the New York Times ever produced. It was on our business desk. It was about a solar-powered house. And it was really poorly done for a couple reasons. But so this was the photo edit for the audio slideshow. This is also every single photo that the photographer submitted. So every single photograph that we had was used to cover up this sort of scratchy telephone audio of this guy talking about his solar-powered house and how people would come over and think they had to bring a coat to dinner, but they didn't. It wasn't my favorite piece by a long shot. But you'll notice here, I mean, things become like painfully obvious when you start looking at, like, you know, we had to use every shot, so like these similar shots of the house, there you go, there's the house again, you know. It's not really illuminating anything, and certainly not respecting photography, I think, as a medium. You know, these images were submitted to the Times with the thought that one of them would end up in the paper, not that we would use every single one in an audio slideshow. But you just don't have any flexibility when you have that few to choose from. And I want to, you know, I don't think a project like this would ever go up on our site today, and we're much more judicious. We do many fewer audio slideshows. We really try and wait for the stories that really, like this is really truly the best medium. I want to then pivot also to another example of a piece that was like a beautiful audio piece, but I think suffered a little bit from this earlier notion of it was just a little too long for what the photos had. This was a very early audio slideshow that was put up on transom.org, in 2007. So this was kind of early experimentation days, and it was really ambitious. It was, and at the time I really liked it. I mean, I left a bunch of praise in the comments, but it showed me a lot about how my own eye has shifted. And when I watched it again, it didn't quite nearly hold my attention in the same way it had. But rather than take you through the whole, because it's quite long too, I think it's about 6 minutes and 30 seconds. But if you look here at the photo edit, some things become clear right away, right? Like there's basically like you have a lot of medium shots. You don't have a lot of variety. You know, you can kind of see like, you know, you've got a lot that sort of feels similar. And then you've got, you know, your main character kind of over and over again, but again, not with a lot of variety. And, you know, you end up using some very, very similar things just to fill the time. And again, so that's that burden of the problem. When the piece is running to 6 minutes, you've got to somehow cover that. And if you've just got a guy in a store working it, it can be very difficult to get the variety that you need. So the answers are either like shoot a whole lot more, you know, so you have more to pick from, or to really bring the length down so that every moment is really rewarding and fresh and sharp. Okay, so I want to actually walk you through a little bit of math here, because this actually does get important when you're dealing with people's attention spans online. So you got a piece that, like that one, which is 6 minutes and 30 seconds long, or that translates to 390 seconds. If you're running, kind of the average length of time we put a photo up, that's you know, you've got about 36 photos. That's more than 10 seconds per photo. That gets a little draggy and long. To be varied and interesting, you've got to like have a better balance. So when you've got 5 seconds per photo, then you need 72 photos for a piece like that. So even just going from 10 seconds, where you're kind of sitting there counting, you know, for each photo, you need double the number of photos to get to sort of a sharper, quicker photo edit. So I want to go back to Todd, who had a good point on this.
I think some of the pieces that have more pictures allow you to listen to the audio better. I don't know why. I just think you're not distracted by the one photograph moving or something.
And I think that's a... Sorry, there was a second half to that quote that didn't play. But I think that's right, that like, the, you know, there's an interesting project right now online by a guy named Jonathan Harris called Cowbird, and he's experimenting with doing a single image and a single audio track, almost in the opposite of what Todd was saying, that like, and I think it's an interesting experiment. I think Jonathan Harris and Cowbird, that project is really trying to figure out, well, what happens if you just have the one image and a really gripping, you know, piece of audio? What happens when you linger very long on kind of one thing? I think it's admirable, but I also think that this whole question of like, how much do we give people, how much do we expect them to really dive in and focus on our solitary image or work, leads us right to a problem that is exactly at the core of like everything I try and figure out every day at work, which is the modern attention span. The fundamental difference for me working online and in multimedia than working on the radio, for example, is that when you're working on the radio, like, people usually have it on, and they're doing something. Maybe they're driving their car, maybe they're washing dishes at home. And what I was taught was in radio, you kind of have to like tap them on the shoulder and like, you know, yank them out of whatever they're doing and say things like, now get this, here's the really important thing you need to know to understand this story. We would use all these tricks in radio to kind of pull people's attention out of whatever they were doing while they had the radio on in the background. Online, those tricks just don't work. You have to get people not only to, you know, ignore all the crazy technology that is neurologically alluring, and you know, ignore their email and ignore their IMs, and you have to get them to choose you. They have to click on you. They have to actively say, I'm going to spend time with you. And And not only that, but then they have to keep choosing you because all that distracting technology is like just like right there. It is so easy to quit the piece that you've spent, you know, a month making. I don't know about you guys, but I see a lot of these projects online, these multimedia projects that are like these big elaborate documentaries with many chapters, and they're beautiful and they look like they took, you know, a year to make and a year to code. And often, you know, I'm trying to be really honest with myself. I don't watch more than like the first like minute of the first chapter. And often I end up clicking away. I see nodding. Yes, yes. The core of that problem is that like we who make the stuff and like love making stuff, I think sometimes forget that you know, maybe not everyone loves our subject as much as we do. It's really easy to kind of fall in love with what you're doing and say, of course everyone's going to want, you know, 30 hours of this kind of footage, and I'm going to just organize it in a cool interactive way, and then everyone will look at it. But I don't think that's the case at all. I want to play you bits of two stories that are essentially the same. And what they do is they do different things to get your attention at the beginning, to get or maybe lose your attention at the beginning. The stories are in similar subject. But all of the things that we've talked about so far, not being literal, using details, having a wide photo take, they're all in play here. And, you know, they do, I think by comparing them, we can look a little bit about what it takes to sort of initially grab and then keep people's attention.
I met Elizabeth at the Hammersmith Palais in London in late 59. It was my 27th birthday precisely when we met, and she was a year older. She had a dazzling smile, a bit like Greer Garson. Feelings developed quite rapidly. We fell in love and married. And then in 1977, she began to develop symptoms. And it turned out to be Huntington's disease. Her balance became bad. She had the characteristic stumbling walk, and her memory was affected. She had difficulty gathering her thoughts. And
okay, I'm gonna sort of trim that here and talk a little bit about, so we already kind of know what this is about at this point. This, you know, man has suffered some loss. We see the woman in the held up slide, so, you know, if she's not around anymore, we'd be seeing pictures of her. It's about loss, sure. It can be emotionally affecting, sure. But right now, you know, I personally, as a you know, viewer who's bombarded with stuff all the time, I don't know if I want to spend more time with this because I feel like I kind of already know what's here. There's no mystery, there's no surprise. Like, you know, and this also suffers from the problem of like, they didn't have a lot to shoot. The woman was gone, so we end up looking at the projector, you know, lens. Like, that's not helping me understand the story, right, as much. Doesn't mean you can't use an abstract detail that would totally, like, hit you over the head emotionally, which is what I think the next piece does so well. This is probably, hands down, my favorite audio slideshow of all time. It's by Liz Balin from the LA Times, and she does really, really amazing work because I think she's very attuned. She's a photographer, trained photographer, got into audio slideshow work, and I think she's very attuned to this question of not being literal and how to be kind of suggestive with both image and sound. And also, you just don't know where this piece is going. I want you to pay particular attention to the first sound that you hear and what, it's not the person's name.
After.
It's okay.
I was saddened today by something that you two could not have known, and for a moment startled at the deterioration of the statue. I hadn't seen it in months, and all of a sudden it's falling apart. And it's a paradigm of me. I'm that old statue. I'm 90. I don't think I'll be 95. 94. I don't think I'll be 91. I've expressed disappointment at arriving alive at the ER, where I sobbed really with disappointment. Oh, damn. It was the perfect time to die. And I believe enough already. A Jew is a person who takes umbrage at an anti-Semitic remark. That's the kind of Jew I am. who recognizes that there's a great urge to somehow live on, to survive yourself, and you make up a hereafter and a deity and a whole panoply of gods and sub-gods and saints and Hall of Fame, and it's such gratuitous bullshit. After Sputnik, we looked around the heavens, and what we found was detritus and debris and junk floating in space. There's no spirit or soul. I will be dead. Get that through your thick head. I'll be dead. And I live, in quotation marks, in my children, in my DNA, in my books, in my reputation. It's as simple as that.
I think there's a whole lot for me anyway that I mean, I've seen this now probably 35 or 40 times, and every time there's something that I notice that I didn't before. Partly because she's doing so much with details. I mean, listen, you have the same problem. You have an old man who's basically homebound, who's sad, who's like, you know, facing death. You would think there's not a lot to photograph there, right? But not only do they start out with this sort of like brilliant and lovely disorientation, which is, you know, I saw something in the garden today that the two of you wouldn't have noticed. I mean, that's not, hi, my name is, you know, Edward Shankman, and I'm probably going to die in the next month. This is like, we just entered his world. And then it gives you this mystery. What is in the garden? Why wouldn't have I understood it? Who are you? Why would you start like that? You've got all these questions that then you want to know about, which is why it's so like, I mean, there's never at any point do I want to click away from this. Second, I think there's just so many kind of lovely suggestive images, you know, whether it's, you know, talking about the end of life where you've got, you know, the unplugged cords or the toaster with the toast in it also unplugged, or God with the empty chairs and the wind vane. I mean, I've played this for a lot of classes, and it's interesting every time different students see different things and they make different connections. But that's sort of the quintessential version of leaving room for the viewer, of not telling people everything they should think or feel about a piece. This is where I think multimedia gets to be more creative and interesting than some kinds of journalism that I work on now, which is much more straightforward. It's about telling people all the facts. And I love that there's space to imagine things in a story like this, that you can kind of reflect and feel like, how does this fit into my own life? I think those are the pieces that we end up carrying with us and telling people about and wanting to see later, is when there's room for us to see ourselves in it. And this piece just does that very, very well. I just have a few more things I want to share with you, and then we're going to open it up to questions. But first, disturbing facts. This is my cousin Riley. Riley really likes baseball, and you know, we sent him an audio slideshow about baseball not too long ago, and my Uncle Mike, Riley's dad, wrote me this. I sent Riley your slideshow about the minor league player. He watched it for a minute or two and then quit. I asked why, and he said if it had been video, he might have watched it all the way through. Which was really interesting to me, right? And like scary. I think that I get asked a lot about like, what do you think about audio slideshows and the future of multimedia? Audio slideshows are a really great format for certain kinds of storytelling. They are slower, they're more ruminative. I think they're more kind of poetic. And there's a lot in video, there's a wide range of video online, obviously, that does a lot of different things. At the same time, we have viewers who write in all the time when we do an audio slideshow and say, hey, that was a great video. They don't notice the difference. All that's not to say that any form is diminished or less or shouldn't be paid attention to, but I do think that audio slideshows and trying to marry two very simple formats, sound and image, are a really great way to sort of start working your process and like what you want to create into patterns that fit with the way people take in information. It's a great way to begin thinking about how to innovate when you're creating different formats, because you've got two very simple inputs and you can create an infinite variety of outputs. The last thought I want to... Oh, wait, sorry. No, another disturbing fact. this is a study that came out in 2010. After watching an online video for a full minute, 44.1% of viewers will have clicked away. An outside slice of the loss occurs in the first 10 seconds. And you know, we've seen this in person. This totally plays out. So all of that is to say that that we have to work harder, we have to work smarter, we have to use teasers, we have to use emotion. And that takes me to my last point, which is what I think audio is so good at doing. But it's to illustrate emotion. And this is the flip side of being literal, right? Like, painting an emotional canvas is the opposite of telling someone a fact and showing them the same fact visually. And so I'm going to play you... See, we have... I'm just checking time. I want to skip to the one. Yes. So... we had a real challenge with this audio slideshow.
I've been in Haiti.
We're not looking at this right now, but the one I'm about to play you was a real problem. We had this beautiful script come in from Haiti about this singer, and it was the most beautiful like audio script I've ever seen come from a Times reporter. The guy used to work in public radio, so it made sense. But the problem was we had no photos for the first half of it. We had a bunch of photos for the second half, but the first half of what he'd written, which was this sort of genius, lovely, gorgeous script, we had nothing. We didn't shoot anything for it. And we were about to scrap it and try and do something different. And then one of the photo editors came over and said, wait a second. We have a lot from Todd Heisler, the guy from 1 in 8 Million, was the one who shot this piece. And it shot a lot of different things when he was down in Haiti, and said, why don't you give it to us and let us see if we can illustrate the emotional kind of valence of this story in the first half. So the first half does that, and I want you to pay attention to how these more abstract images are used to illustrate what the journalist is saying. And then the second half is a much more traditional audio slideshow. It's a much more traditional kind of portrait. But also keep in mind that Todd had very little time with the subject and was shooting a lot of images to do what he talked about, to cover for the story. So you're kind of getting both. Like, he's sort of gaming out the second half. The second half he's trying to make sure there's enough to fill the storyline. And the first half is a really creative, illustrative, kind of suggestive, metaphorical edit.
I've been in Haiti twice since the January earthquake. My driver, Manon, and my translator, Christian, have guided me through the streets of Port-au-Prince into tent camps, slums, trash dumps, hospitals, and everywhere else. It was in the car with them where I first heard this. This is Bekin. I started asking Manon and Christian about the songs. They said Bekin was singing about Haiti's suffering. Bekin is what Haitians call a troubadour, a solo artist with a guitar who sings directly to their audience. As I saw such suffering on a massive scale all around me, I also found Bekin's haunting songs about loss, seduction, and the yearning for a better future therapeutic. As I interviewed other Haitians, I realized that many of them were also listening to Bekin's music. I found some of his CDs for sale by street vendors who made bootleg versions for $1.30 a piece. Some of them had sold out of his songs completely. I wanted to find Bekin and talk to him about this. When we found him, I was shocked. He was living in a tent camp in Place Saint-Pierre, one of the most squalid communities of displaced people in the earthquake. His home had been partially destroyed. He was chain-smoking and clearly under a lot of stress. Bekin also faced the additional challenge of being handicapped after losing his leg in a car accident when he was a child.
Mr. Bekin, c'est une musique. Je l'ai composé, je l'ai traversé un impasse.
Bekin Misery is a song that I wrote when I was going through a very, very difficult impasse. That's when I say, this misery, it's hard to get me. If I don't scream, I will choke.
Bekin hadn't composed anything since the earthquake. Doing so when the pain was so fresh from the disaster, he said, was too overwhelming. I asked him if he would be willing to play a few songs for us. He took us to a small restaurant in Pétionville where he played in the past. The owner set up a chair for him and his guitar.
I love
He began hesitatingly at first. But after smoking a cigarette and sipping a prestige beer, he began playing favorites like Humiliation and Fang Se Kaju. Becken got into the rhythm, and so did his audience. Some in the restaurant began singing along with him. I then witnessed something I hadn't seen in Haiti since arriving the day after the earthquake. People in the restaurant were having fun. They were drinking beer and eating goat head soup. For a while, they forgot the wrecked city around them. Becken himself also smiled that night. He said then that maybe now he could write a new song. For the New York Times, in Port-au-Prince, this is Simon Romero.
So you can see how in the beginning, I mean, basically until you meet Becken, they were kind of like, he was kind of like this character that they were keeping off stage a little bit. Basically the photo editors had to find a way to illustrate the emotion that was in the script rather than the literal thing. There were no pictures of the driver, the translator. There were no pictures of them in their car driving around Haiti doing their other reporting. But I think the first half really worked, and it showed how you can use sort of more suggestive metaphorical imagery to make a piece work. I also want to jump now because I want to make sure we have time for questions. But I want to leave you with this thought from Auden, which is that the ear tends to be lazy, craves the familiar, and is shocked by the unexpected. The eye, on the other hand, tends to be impatient, craves the novel, and is bored by repetition. I think it's just a really interesting thought about the way that our senses interact. And I think audio slideshows and this kind of multimedia storytelling is a really wonderful way to kind of dip your toe into the world of thinking about how people take in stories at a time when the way that people are taking in stories is changing, like every other week, it seems like. So with that, thank you so much for listening, and I would love to take any questions you have for the next few minutes.